Welcome to Marketplace. I'm Raghu Manavalan. Happy New Year. To wrap up 2013, we're doing something different. A podcast of 10 driveway moments from the year. The staff here at Marketplace picked our favorites, and healthcare, not surprisingly, kept popping up. One special story developed from a very simple question. How do doctors die differently than the rest of us? In fact, only a third of patients die the way they want, at home, surrounded by the people who love them. That's according to Medicare. Most people die in hospitals, tethered to machines and feeding tubes, or in nursing homes. As part of a series we reported with the New York Times, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein visited three doctors facing terminal illness.
Deep breath. Okay, good.
Brave. You hear that word a lot when people are sick. But when Elizabeth McKinley's family and friends talk about bravery, it's not as much about the way McKinley, a 53-year-old internist, has battled breast cancer. It's about doing what so few of us can, stop fighting.
Wow, listen, that sounds good. That's nice and clear, and you know how we heard that.
Last spring, after McKinley's cancer had found its way into her liver, lungs, and the tissue surrounding her brain, her doctor told her she had two options.
You can put chemo directly into your brain or total brain irradiation.
Blood pressure real quick.
I'm looking at these drugs head on, and either one would change me significantly. I don't want that.
What McKinley wanted was time with her husband, a radiologist, their two college-age kids, and another chance to soak her feet in the Atlantic Ocean.
I want to have another summer with my family, maybe, or a little more time being me and not being somebody else.
So after 17 years, McKinley stopped treatment for her cancer and started weekly hospice visits to be as comfortable as possible for the short time that's left. Her mother didn't understand. She asked McKinley's husband, Chip Gillickson, if there wasn't something more to do.
And almost bite my tongue to say, do you have any idea how much disease your daughter has?
McKinley and her husband were looking at her disease as doctors who know the limits of medicine. Her mother was looking at her daughter's cancer like a mother, clinging to the promise of medicine as limitless. When it comes to dying, it's surely every bit as wrenching for doctors as it is for the rest of us. But they have a clear advantage. They've seen death up close. They have access to the best medicine has to offer, and they understand their choices.
You've got a lot of knowledge, a lot of awareness of what's likely to come.
That's Andrew Billings. For 30 years as a palliative care doctor, he helped his patients manage pain, map out their treatment options, and planned end-of-life care. Now,
here we are in the infusion unit.
He's the patient with a rare form of lymphoma.
I am hooked up to an intravenous line, which is hooked up to a pump, which is hooked up to me through a port.
Last month, I spent time with Billings as he sat through the first of several hours of chemotherapy at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston.
We've got harp music today, it looks like. I'm going to waft up to heaven.
In the 6 months he's been diagnosed, Billings says being a doctor has helped. For example, he and his wife, Susan Block, also a palliative care doctor, knew just what to do after a round of chemo this summer left him ravaged and exhausted. Block says they asked for Ritalin, the drug often used for attention deficit disorder.
Most patients, I don't think, would know to ask about, could we try some Ritalin to use for this fatigue? And yet, I know, and Andy knows because of our fields, that that's a really great drug and that it makes a huge difference in being able to be more part of the living while you're there.
Being as comfortable as you can is a lesson for everyone to learn, says Dr. Diane Meyer from the Center to Advance Palliative Care at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York.
The people who feel better, who are less anxious, whose pain is controlled, they're not using up all their bodily energy just to get through the day. So I think we're pretty convinced that it will help us live longer as well.
As a doctor, Billings has had a level of control few patients ever get. But even Billings, whose cancer is in remission, hit the same wall so many other patients do. He doesn't have a great handle on his prognosis.
I've looked at the survival curves, and I don't know which dot I am, but there's some dots that are very, very soon, And there's some dots that are a long ways off, and I just hope I'm one of those.
If anyone can coax a prognosis out of his doctor, it's Billings, with 30 years treating patients at the end of life. But even he couldn't.
It's hard to ask those questions, hard to get answers.
It turns out doctors don't like to talk about the end. Studies show few offer patients a prognosis, and when they do, they often overestimate the time someone has left. In fact, the better a doctor knows his patient, the rosier the outlook. Billings says it's the doctor's responsibility to help patients get their bearings.
I think they need to give a prognosis, which can be very simple, like, you know you have a very serious illness, and I wonder if you've thought about it getting worse. In other words, you don't need to go right to your dead ducky. Don't buy any green bananas.
When physicians don't lay out the road ahead, University of Washington Professor of Medicine Dr. Anthony Bach says patients can end up where they least want to be, the ICU.
Many of those people have ended up in those places because they haven't realized the implications of saying, yeah, I'll have that one more treatment. Yeah, I'll have that chemotherapy.
Patients and families often pay a high price for these difficult and unscripted deaths, psychologically and economically. The Dartmouth Atlas Project found nearly 20% of Medicare's $550 billion annual budget is spent on the last 6 months of life. Atlas senior researcher David Goodman did the analysis.
The evidence is very clear that if we respect patients' preferences, most patients will choose less aggressive care and care that costs less.
But what sounds simple can be difficult, even for doctors.
I'm Ken Zeitler. I'm now 64, and I'm a medical oncologist.
Zeitler lives in Raleigh, North Carolina. He's the son of a doctor, the father of two doctors, and a cancer specialist. He was diagnosed 18 years ago with a brain tumor. Consistently, Zeitler and his family have mapped out a clear medical path. Then last June, he woke up with the left half of his body paralyzed after a low-risk biopsy caused a hemorrhage. Zeitler hadn't fully explained to his family losing control of his body was one of his deepest fears, and he regretted it.
As a physician, I did have to listen to this inner voice. In this case, you know, I was enraged. I hadn't listened to those. I felt like, you know, I'd screwed myself.
Zeitler realized afterwards saying no can mean more than turning down a procedure. It can mean dealing with something much harder, the emotional pull of family who want you with them no matter what.
Quality of life means different things to different people, and you have to decide for yourself, I guess with your family, but ultimately it's a personal decision.
Over the last decade, there are signs that the end-of-life choices we're making are slowly shifting. Medicare figures show fewer people are dying in the hospital, and there's been a modest increase in hospice care. And you've got people like Elizabeth McKinley back in Cleveland, a person who just acknowledges what's in front of her.
People always tell me, you know, you've got other options. I don't feel like I have other options. I think my option is to figure this out and go forward.
Since this spring, friends and caregivers have come and gone. McKinley's hospice bed right in the living room. Her daughter calls it meeting death at the front door. McKinley says she liked that expression.
Yeah, I think allowing death to be at the front door allows us to talk more about life in reality. Because I think that's what we're talking about.
McKinley's goal was to find a way to maximize a good life. In her final days, friends and family say she did. Elizabeth McKinley died November 9th at home, where she wanted to be. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Other big headlines? Edward Snowden and the NSA. The loss of online privacy wasn't really news to Marketplace reporter Stacey Vanek Smith, though. She's been reporting for years on how retail companies are tracking everything we do. For this story, she asked a data mining company to see what they could dig up.
Ads on my Facebook page. Discount Coach handbags. An amazing miracle diet. Tom's shoes and pepper spray. That seemingly motley selection has actually been carefully curated by Facebook based on what the site knows about me.
What's amazing is when you target an ad at the right person, results go up 1,000+%.
Russell Glass is the CEO of Bizzo, a data profiling company that helps clients like American Express, Mercedes, and IBM reach business professionals. It uses information it gathers from more than 3,000 sites across the web.
they're sending us information like, oh, this is this person's title and company name, whether they're going to business sites or they're going to social media like Facebook or LinkedIn.
Bizzo takes that information and builds a data profile.
Well, yes, I found your birthday. You know, I know that you're 30-something.
Stephen Cobb is a data researcher with ESET, an online security company. Using just my name, Cobb set off on a kind of data scavenger hunt to build a profile of me. And I'm 36, by the way.
I had the building you're in, the unit that you're in. Then I looked into what you do online.
Cobb says most of us use the same username for all of our online accounts. Once he figured out mine, he quickly found my online hangouts, Twitter, eBay, LinkedIn.
You do have this very strong interest in movies and TV. That was shown by the multiple services that you've subscribed to, which I think is all of the main TV and streaming video sites.
You know, my last data profile said this too. And can I just say one more time, for the record, that I do not watch that much television. I'm reading Middlemarch. Anyway, it got a whole lot creepier.
A more detailed map of who your friends are that you hang out with most often. You like eating at the In-N-Out Burger. You like Imogen Heap.
What the hell?
And also sitting on the sand with friends.
Is going on.
Wait, is that from the picture I took with Heather like 5 years ago?
I hesitated to mention that it was Heather, but yes, that is Heather.
Okay, that did not come up in 2010. But there is a lot more data out there now, and data profilers can cross-reference their data with data from other profilers, like Axiom, one of the giants, which slots us all into one of 70 consumer groups. 3 years ago, I was a savvy single.
I found that you fit into cluster number 29, a middling single. Don't take it personally.
Oh, my God.
So you are markedly single, childless, and urban.
Markedly single? What is that supposed to mean?
And you might enjoy this. As residents in the nation's biggest cities, this group enjoys a rich cultural existence. Hopefully you are enjoying a rich cultural existence.
I am! I do not just watch television.
And you mix an extensive amount of travel, museum visits, and the arts with bar hopping and dancing.
So basically, I'm an alcoholic, vaguely artistic, couch potato spinster. As much as I might not like my data profile, as far as marketers are concerned, Stacey Vanek Smith, middling single, is the only Stacey Vanek Smith they want to know. And increasingly, they all want to know, says Bizzo's Russell Glass.
In the first few years, we had to work really hard to help people understand what a targeted ad was. And today, people are coming to us saying, hey, we want to target ads at business people.
Data profiling is already a $30 billion a year business and growing fast. So I can expect to see more tailored ads for miracle diets and cheap designer handbags and all of the other things that middling singles need to keep middling on. Actually, a little bar hopping sounds pretty good right about now. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
What you say? Just what we need.
You can find out what marketers know about you with our consumer profiler. It's online at marketplace.org.
In this report from David Gura, he combined two of our favorite things, the government shutdown and poetry.
Let's start with the government shutdown. Right now, the government is shut down because Congress has not passed a bill to fund the government. Or,
suppose that you went to the grocery store.
That's Senator Mike Lee from Utah.
You went to that grocery store and you put bread and milk and eggs in your basket.
And if shopping's not your thing, how about this nature simile, courtesy of Representative Lloyd Doggett?
Like those periodic cicadas that trouble different parts of the country?
Attempt to clarify becomes like a poem by an avant-garde surrealist poet.
That's two-time U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky. He says metaphors can complicate things. That's happening with the debt limit. In simple terms, Congress sets a limit on how much money the executive branch can borrow to pay the bills. Here, the analogies have been more bellicose. There's been talk of a ticking time bomb, a nuclear weapon, ransom.
They don't get to hold the entire economy hostage
over ideological demands.
President Obama also compared the situation to a family's budget, and he's not the only one to use that imperfect analogy. Here's Congressman Joe Barton.
We have, in my household budget, some bills that have to be paid and some bills that we can defer or only pay partially.
And so many metaphors lead to mixed metaphors. Jeff Schessel was a speechwriter for President Clinton.
Somewhere in the middle of this long tunnel as we head toward the goalposts, there's a cliff. It's hard to imagine what that actually looks like physically.
Poet Robert Pinsky confides he has a secret ambition, and that is to be a speechwriter.
What I would love to do is try to see how plain I could make some of these points, the difference between a default and a sequester and a debt ceiling, and I think people would appreciate it.
Pinsky says politicians would have a lot more success if they could explain these things in plain English. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Back in July, we did a lot of reporting on the BART strike. Bay Area traffic was crippled for a few days when employees walked off the job. Outspoken Silicon Valley tech has went so far as to say some BART jobs should just be automated. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark introduced a dot-com CEO to one union worker.
During the BART strike back in July, I talked to a guy named Richard White. He's the CEO of a tech startup in San Francisco called User Voice. He'd been on Facebook grumbling about the traffic that had been unleashed on his staff. And here's what he said about the striking BART workers.
My solution would be to pay them whatever the hell they want, get them back to work, and then go figure out how to automate all their jobs.
When this idea went out on the radio, some cheered White on, but many found it offensive. A few threatened to stop using White software, which happens to automate parts of the customer service experience for business. I wondered if White had had any second thoughts. So I went to his office in downtown San Francisco recently to ask. It had all the requisite tech startup accessories, beer-filled fridge in the break room, air hockey.
The largest air hockey table we could get in the building.
In the conference room next door, we sat down to talk.
All right.
And White was quick to tell me that he probably did sound a little callous with that automation proposal.
Here's this, like, rich CEO app. He gets mildly inconvenienced, and he just says, let's just do away with all these people and replace them with robots.
He said, when you're thinking about technology all day,
sometimes you do have sociopathic tendencies. You do things kind of in a vacuum, right? The prototypical worker will be displaced by this. It's different than saying, Claire over here will be displaced by that.
But that is what's going to happen to Claire, he said.
Eventually, these things are going to be automated. It's not just BART, but it's lots of jobs. My point was, we need to think about these things.
White thinks about them a lot, he tells me. As he moves through his day, going to work, doing errands, he can almost see technology eating up the world.
Everywhere I walk in San Francisco, I notice there's a job that I don't think will be there in 15 years.
And so we went for a walk down 2nd Street toward the BART station near his office.
All the tech companies are in this area for the most part.
On the way, a taxi driver cruised by in his cab. At least that's what I saw. For White, that's a future
self-driving car.
And that checkout clerk at the corner store that we pass by, soon enough, he'll be a
self-service kiosk.
In White's view, automation isn't just an inevitable thing, it's a good thing. We should take the routine jobs people do and
automate as much of their day as possible so they can have more time to do the more valuable things.
But as we move down the streets of the technology capital of America, looking at the world through tech utopia tinted glasses, there's this voice in my head.
Isn't this the kind of stuff that's been worrying so many of the economists I talk to? That as technology advances at a faster and faster pace, it's vaporizing a lot of the middle-class jobs that used to employ people without college degrees or super specialized skills.
By this point, back on the streets of San Francisco, Richard White and I had arrived at our destination.
So we're right at the entrance to the Montgomery BART station.
What makes this place so interesting is that BART has become something of an anomaly in the new economy. With so much automation across all kinds of American industries, the thousands of unionized jobs at BART are a rare breed today in that they don't require college degrees or super specialized skills, but still bring in a decent middle-class salary. Take that station agent in the glass booth.
Come for the emergency exit.
Helping someone figure out which train to get on. A job like hers makes an average base salary of $64,000 a year. BART workers say the strike is about making sure those good salaries stay good. But in Richard White's eyes,
that's a lot of money to pay someone to answer questions about how to get from point A to point B. I have a map in my pocket at all times to tell me that.
He pointed at the Google Map app on his smartphone, meaning that station agent job?
That's clearly a job that could be automated.
We watched the agent from a distance for a while.
Thank you.
welcome.
She was smiling and wishing her customers a good day.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
At some point, I asked White, so that whole automate her job thing.
How do you feel about asking her how she would feel about it?
He turned a little red.
Well, it's okay. She's such a nice lady, right?
Because I will probably afterwards ask her, but do you want to be
sure,
part of it?
I know.
Okay.
We went up to the booth.
Hi.
White was a little shy, so I explained to the agent behind the glass that the guy I'm with thought she seemed really nice, but also that a robot could probably do most of her job.
What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I don't just sit here all day.
Her name was Lanice Landry, and at first she was a little defensive. But then she tried to reason with White, listed the stuff she does, helping people figure out the route maps, assisting the elderly.
A lot of people don't speak English either.
White nodded, but he wasn't convinced.
That makes sense. So I wonder if you have to be right here, right? If we could have, like, you could just work from home and you could actually just have a screen here and they ask you questions.
Honey, you're talking about way futuristic stuff. Come on now. I've been in customer service for about 10 years, and I do realize people don't read. Hi.
As if on cue, a frantic-looking lady with a suitcase ran up to the window and interrupted our little debate.
Hi, sorry. No,
come on, honey. Can you add money?
She was rushing to the airport and couldn't figure out the ticket machine. Landry came out of her booth to help.
Okay, so press yes.
And here's your receipt for your records.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Landry turned back to us and said, see?
Everything can be automated. And a lot of people do feel better having another person there.
But if your job was automated, I asked, what would you do?
I would do my hobby, which would be hair and makeup and buy and sell houses.
And now White is nodding.
See, wouldn't it be perfect if she actually could, like, pursue her hobby?
And yes, that would be very cool. But it's not what seems to be happening, at least yet. In studies that have tracked people over the last few decades who lost jobs because of automation or globalization, those people usually wound up with lower paying jobs or no jobs at all. Some economists say it'll take time, but ultimately automation will be a net good in the future, just like it was in the Industrial Revolution. Others aren't so sure. Richard White says these questions trouble him, too. But he says those are the kinds of complicated challenges that a techie like him can't solve on his own. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
I'm pretty sure there is not one single person alive who actually likes parking tickets. Urban Dictionary defines the job meter maid as the lowest form of life on Earth. This was for our aptly titled series, You Hate My Job. Marketplace host Kai Rizadal tagged along with traffic enforcement officer Jenny Day.
Look at that. You just zip it into this little handheld gizmo and boom.
That's it.
9 years on the job.
And that's it.
That's just crazy fast.
So
boom,
we try to
done.
Do it. The faster we do it, the faster, I mean, you can avoid so much confrontation.
Thousands of parking tickets, probably more.
Anybody ever call you meter maid?
Oh, yeah, every day.
You all right with that?
Yeah, that's fine.
How much time do you spend in this job just shaking your head going, man, people are just amazing?
Every 2 minutes. Yeah.
And yet you keep coming back?
Oh, yeah.
So we're at the corner of, where are we, Union and 6th in downtown L.A. So tell me what you do as you drive around. Are you looking for people with red flashing parking meters or parked in red zones?
You look for everything. You look for meters. You look for loading zones. You look for people in red, like the gentleman right here. You get behind him. You ask him to move. Most of the time they do.
And you're signaling to get out of the way. Oh, there he goes. Do you ever feel like sometimes, like you're, you know how people feel like they're going to the dentist? Do you ever feel like that sometimes? Like you're the dentist?
More like the Grim Reaper for some people. We're taking money out of their pocket, regardless of whether they're wrong. They, you know, we're still taking their money.
Well, you know,
that's the way they look at us.
Well, that's a really interesting point, right? I mean, you guys are a revenue source for the city of Los Angeles.
Correct. Revenue source, but we're also here more on the safety part of it. We also take care of stolen vehicles. We take care of all the abandoned work. We do all the traffic control.
Do you have quotas? Do you have a number you have to give out every day?
No, not at all.
So how are you guys evaluated on job performance then?
We have what we call monthlies, where every month you'll sit down with your sergeant. They'll explain to you this is what you've been doing, because everything counts.
All right, so what's the worst part of this job?
I think the redundancy of driving around and just being called the B word all day long. And that's pretty, I mean, but you get immune to it like everything else.
So you probably know the best place to get a cup of coffee or a good greasy spoon breakfast or like a burrito or something around here, right?
In this area, not really. I don't really eat where I sight.
You just got to.
Yeah.
I don't eat where I sight. Oh,
man. You don't really want to eat where you give people tickets. You might get E. coli or something.
I get that.
Yeah, you want to stray away from here.
So what's the ugliest thing anybody ever said to you? I mean, have they gotten personally abusive and physical and all that?
They've pulled out a gun on me.
Really?
Yes. For trying to take their vehicle for being parked over 72 hours.
And what'd you do?
LAPD was called.
Yeah.
The guy was caught. He was arrested.
He stood there with a gun on you while you called the cops?
Yeah.
Wow.
They came back and arrested him and took his car.
And took his car.
Yeah.
And his gun and, you know, all of that stuff. Man, that's crazy.
It actually did make me think twice, like, do I really want to be here? But it's not, I mean, that's not something that happens all the time. It's not something, it's just something that this guy had an issue. Either he was high or he really liked his car. I don't know. You know, he had sentimental feelings. I don't know.
Yeah.
I was back at work the next day like nothing happened.
Did you take the rest of the day off that day, though?
Actually, no, I didn't.
Should have. Just put that on your time card. Almost got shot.
Almost. Need to change pants.
All in all, in just under an hour, we gave out 6 tickets, no guns drawn, even got a thank you from a guy as Officer Day handed him his citation. But then, on the way back to Marketplace headquarters, we saw that same truck still parked in a red zone.
See, he stayed there and he took his ticket.
Wow. So you give him another one?
No, I won't. But if another officer comes by and sees that there's no ticket on the vehicle, he'll give him another ticket. Right.
So he should have really just stuck it under the windshield.
Yes. If you receive a citation, always leave it there.
That's today's Marketplace Helpful Tip.
Brought to you by Jenny Day.
Slightly above parking tickets on the Things You Hate scale, being asked, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Commentator James Drummond gives us a few hypothetical answers.
Since no one can see the future, I will answer by presenting 10 possible scenarios, which, admittedly, vary in their likelihood. Nevertheless, I feel it is best to try to be thorough so that at least one of the scenarios may prove true in 5 years. Please note that during previous performance reviews, I have been repeatedly told that I need to think outside the box. Scenario 1. In 5 years, I will have received a promotion. Scenario 2. In 5 years, the company will have realized what a hardworking, intelligent, and loyal employee I have been, and will reward me for my long and dedicated service with a generous raise and a bonus. My performance rating will go from the unwarranted needs improvement to exceeds expectations. Scenario 3. In 5 years, I will have risen to the position of vice president. Scenario 4. In 5 years, I will own the entire company. Scenario 5. In 5 years, I will have given up trying to understand the phrase, think outside the box. Scenario 6. In 5 years, I will be living outside in a box. Scenario 7. In 5 years, I start working on a time machine in my garage at night. Scenario 8. Using my time machine, I have gone back and prevented the meeting of the man and woman who, without my intervention, would have eventually given birth to the HR person who came up with the question, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Scenario 9. In 5 years, I will be doing more with less. Scenario 10. In 5 years, I will be filling out this form again.
China's economic growth and its global impact is undeniably one of the biggest business stories of the year. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz boiled all of that down to one street in Shanghai, the Street of Eternal Happiness. In a series of reports, he looked at how China is changing for the people who live there. In this story, he uncovered a box of letters at a local antique shop.
30 years of letters between a husband and his wife. The husband in prison near Tibet. The wife raising 7 children on the Street of Eternal Happiness. Despite all of China's changes, the stucco townhome where they lived is still here. It's surrounded by dumpling stands, boutique fashion shops, swanky hotels, capitalism. 60 years ago, being a capitalist could ruin your life. A government song from the 1950s forecasted painful days ahead for those on the wrong side of communism. After communists took over China, they seized a silicon steel factory in Shanghai belonging to a man we'll call Wang Ming. The problem was, officials had no idea how to run the factory. A local official privately encouraged Wang to start a separate factory to help save the reputation of the government one. In a letter yellowed by time, Wang writes in the meticulous calligraphy of China's educated class, explaining what happened next.
After I built my own factory, the government sentenced me to prison for making money in an illegal way. I was sent here to Qinghai to be reformed.
It was 1,000 miles away. In a letter dated September 6, 1958, Wang's wife, Li Shuyun, writes to her husband that life at home is getting difficult.
Dear Ming, we've run out of money. I've had to sell a lot of our things to get by, but I've just found a job at a factory. The eldest daughters are taking care of the younger ones, so please don't worry. Work hard and accept your re-education. Becoming a new person is the only way out.
Re-education meant that Wang had to unlearn things like individualism and capitalism. Wang worked at a labor camp where prisoners were routinely beaten and starved. Wei Xiezhong, a retired professor in Nanjing, was a fellow inmate of Wang's.
The camp was in the desert. If you tried to escape, you'd die from exposure, so there weren't even any walls around it.
Wei remembers barely surviving China's famine in the early 60s. Tens of millions of Chinese starved to death.
I remember going out in the morning and seeing inmates too weak to work, leaning against the walls. After the sun went down, I'd come back and they were dead.
Back on the street of eternal happiness, Li Shuyun continued to struggle. In a letter to her husband in 1964, she says she's so poor that she's had to give away their youngest daughter.
She was adopted by the family of a carpenter. Don't worry. Someday we'll be reunited, as long as you diligently study proletariat thought and get rid of your bourgeoisie ideas.
Proletariat thought, bourgeoisie ideas, the letters are full of these slogans. Wang and Li wrote these things to please government censors who were inspecting their mail. But in 1970, Wang ignores the lingo in a letter to his wife.
Dearest Shuyun, it's my fault that you're alone with all these burdens and responsibilities of raising our family. I feel so alone. Please send pictures of the family so my homesickness can be cured.
There are more than 100 letters between Wang and Li. They discuss how their 7 children are growing and changing, becoming adults and getting married without the guidance of their father. After reading all these letters, I began looking for Wang and Li's family. I start at their old home on the Street of Eternal Happiness. An elderly neighbor tells me they left years ago. The father died, she tells me, but the mother's still alive. She left China 5 years ago with her only son to go to America. I tracked down Wang Ming's son in New York City. Before he agrees to talk to me, the son asks that his family's real names not be used. He still has sisters back in China, and the family's been through enough political trouble as it is. Wang Jie is 56. He lives with his mother in the first floor of a house in the Chinese community of Flushing. Li Shuyun is now 87. She's suffering from Alzheimer's. Wang spent his life taking care of her. He never got married. Wang works at a factory, repairing cell phones. He earns minimum wage. It may not be the American dream, but Wang says he's okay with that.
After the hell my family's been through, this is heaven.
Wang tells me his father died 3 years ago. He spent his last years in a nursing home, which is odd in China, where it's customary for the children to care for parents at home as they die. Wang doesn't explain why. But when I ask him if he blames China's government for what happened to his father, he hints at how his family saw his father.
His salary was good, and we could have all lived a stable life, but he was unsatisfied and wanted to make more. He should have known running his own factory was illegal.
Wang doesn't like to think about his life back in China, but one memory stands out. When Wang was 20 years old, his father was released from prison. Wang remembers going to the Shanghai train station with his sisters to pick him up.
The problem was we didn't know what he looked like, and he didn't recognize us either, so we missed each other completely.
After looking for some time, they went home and waited. It was on the Street of Eternal Happiness where he finally met his dad. Today, the family home has the same weathered red door and the same creaky stairs, but it's surrounded by a completely different China. The propaganda music from decades ago is gone. A street musician prefers to play songs from pre-communist China. I ask Wang about the letters. Would he like to see them? He doesn't even pause to think. No, he says. They weren't anything special, he tells me. Talk to any Chinese who lived through that time. We all have the same stories. He says his parents' letters should have been left in a trash can years ago on the Street of Eternal Happiness. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace's Amy Scott spent a year profiling a school in Cincinnati, Euler School. The entire radio project is worth listening to. You can find it at marketplace.org. And in this story, she looks at how a single school can change the community around it.
It's just a few hours till graduation, and Principal Craig Hockenberry steps out for one of his last walks around the neighborhood before the school year ends.
What's up, Nate?
He shakes hands with the postman making his rounds.
Graduation tonight.
Okey-dokey.
Big party on State Street.
The neighborhood is looking good. Crews of volunteers have been clearing out trash and old tires. Hockenberry spots a row of brick houses being painted.
We need every house done like this.
Along the way, neighbors and former students try to score tickets to the ceremony.
Stop over, man. I'll get you in if you want to watch it.
Euler is gearing up for a crowd. This is only the fourth official class to graduate from the high school. Before Euler added the upper grades and all the community services, very few kids from the neighborhood got diplomas. Jamie Lugan is the school's resource coordinator.
People come, whether they have kids here or not, just to sit and watch because high school graduation was not a part of the culture down here. And they just come to see, like, the success of the kids of the neighborhood.
Hockenberry says graduation can get rowdy.
It makes me feel a little uncomfortable because I always think of these as very solemn, but I also got to remember that this is more than just the child graduating. This is the day that eluded their mothers, their fathers, their grandparents, and everybody else. So have fun, Lower Price Hill.
And Lower Price Hill does not disappoint. At 5 o'clock, the seniors file into Euler's stately Art Deco auditorium. The young men in black caps and gowns, the women in silver. A mom crouches in front to snap pictures. Principal Hockenberry takes the podium.
It is my pleasure and my honor to welcome you all to Euler School, the pride of Cincinnati Public.
The pride of Cincinnati Public. It's how he answers the phone, signs his emails. It's all part of Hockenberry's campaign to turn things around at Euler, the reality and the perception.
There was a lot of lack of pride in this community, in this neighborhood. And I personally believe if you say something enough, that you slowly start to believe it.
As students have made steady progress on test scores, he says people don't laugh anymore. But he knows Euler has a long way to go. It's ranked in the bottom 5% of schools in the state, partly because its official graduation rate, the percentage of kids who start in ninth grade and finish in 4 years, is so low, less than 36% last year. But of those who make it to senior year, the majority cross the finish line, 41 students this year. One by one, they walk across the stage to collect their diplomas.
Raven, Olivia, Raven.
In a back corner, the Gribbins family erupts. Raven's father, grandfather, and grandmother all went to Euler. None of them finished school. A week before graduation, Raven was accepted at Penn State's Greater Allegheny campus. She wants to study math and education. There's still the very real question of how to pay for it. Even after grants and government loans, she still needs to come up with $11,000 for next year, which probably means more debt. She sees it as the price of a better life.
If you don't have a college degree, you're always living paycheck to paycheck, struggling. And then you always end up doing something you don't want to do. So when you go get your degree, then you can do what you like to do.
Most of Raven's classmates plan to attend at least some college. A few are headed for apprenticeships or trade school. About a third will go straight into the workforce. But a lot can happen over the summer. Just before the ceremony, Hockenberry ran into one of his most promising seniors from last year. College didn't work out.
I see kids that graduated from Euler that just, they didn't make it. So now, instead of being a dropout, they're walking the streets and doing drugs with a diploma. And we don't want that to happen. We got a million success stories, but You know, we don't want to lose anybody.
After the ceremony, everyone pours out onto Hatmaker Street. A few families fire up some barbecues for a cookout in the parking lot. The celebration is tinged with sadness. The night before, an Oiler parent with kids in preschool and kindergarten was shot and killed in front of his house. Hockenberry says there's less violent crime in the neighborhood since the school reopened this year after a renovation, but it's never far away.
So even though, you know, we make a lot of progress here, we take steps back often, and that's the challenge here in the inner city. So
he'll be back next year to take up the challenge again. A few months ago, his job was on the line because of a budget gap. The district renewed his contract with a pay cut. He's already cooking up plans for next year, a dental clinic inside the school and a barber shop. And as we talk for the last time this school year, another idea takes shape.
It's almost like we need an office of post-secondary, you know what I mean? Like, to follow the kids, especially now that we're in the hundreds, you know?
Kids who, a decade ago, may never have finished high school. In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
If you only listen to Marketplace on the radio, you might not have heard our Deep Book series that runs as part of our podcast, previewing fun facts about the coming day. You might not think July 3rd was a particularly eventful day in history, and, well, you'd be right.
From the Marketplace Deep Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The thermostat is rising. We enter the dog days of summer. Need some heavy metal to go with that? If you're in Guilford, New Hampshire, you can start banging your head tomorrow when Megadeth's Gigantour opens. And on July 3rd, 1890, Idaho was admitted to the Union. You might be wondering, can you cook an Idaho potato in the microwave? Yes. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
And finally, at the end of the year, it's important to reflect back on how we changed and what we lost. Adrian Hill bids farewell to the 40 and 60 watt incandescent light bulb, which will no longer be for sale in 2014.
We gather here to say goodbye to the 40 and 60 watt incandescent light bulb.
Oh my God. I mean, tears are coming to my eyes. I'm kidding, but I'm not really kidding.
Kathy Prisgoda is principal lighting designer for Light Studio LA.
It's something that allowed us to glow and dim.
LA interior designer Ruth Stork has worked with and known these bulbs for years.
I think it's a feeling that you're going to miss. It's the feeling of a space that has a natural warmth to it, and that really comes from lighting.
We know, like all creations, this bulb wasn't perfect. It burned hot. It was wasteful. But we celebrate. The new generation owes its success to the passing generation. We've asked the inventor of the bulb to share his thoughts, Thomas Edison, via Edison impersonator R.J. Lindsay.
Well, I suppose I could use the title that's been applied, the Wizard of Menlo Park.
How do you feel, Mr. Edison, that your incandescent light bulb is now being phased out?
Well, I'll tell you, if I were still inventing, I would have invented whatever they're going to phase me out with.
Derek Porter is a professor at Parsons, the New School for Design. We've asked him for the appropriate epitaph.
Best wishes, warm friend.
Best wishes, warm friend. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
These are just a few of our favorite stories from 2013. What are yours? Head over to marketplace.org and leave us a comment, or tell us on Facebook or Twitter. Thanks for listening. Here's to 2014.